will fit in right with thermodynamics, I'm almost positive. In fact, I'm going to steal a little bit from what I'm guessing he will do at that lecture, from the way he affects his performance. We're talking about thermodynamics, and I've tried to ease you into it a little bit. But the basis of thermodynamics is found in two mathematical equations. In science, we as scientists think that we have really accomplished something and performed a great synthesis when we get as much science as we can in some very simple, profound mathematical statements. I've mentioned several times that quantum mechanics is based on five postulates, at least one formulation of quantum mechanics. Now this makes that formalization something like geometry. That's what you do in geometry. You make what seem to be reasonable postulates, and then from those reasonable postulates, you expand out as far as you can. For example, it seems reasonable that a straight line is the shortest distance between two points. And that is an axiom of geometry. There's no way that anyone knows how to prove that. It just seems reasonable. Jeff?
Doesn't it seem reasonable also that a particle traveling from one point to another must also at some point occupy all the different positions?
All the points in between.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems reasonable to me. There are things about science that are bothersome. And maybe you or someone else in your generation can straighten things out. Quantum mechanics has bothered a lot of people. Einstein greatly disliked quantum mechanics. He very reluctantly accepted the ideas. He never felt good about them. And there are many who are still that way. I feel uneasy about a lot of the ideas. But it's the best description that you can make. Now, the whole science of thermodynamics can be based on two equations. And I sometimes forget those, so I always have my notes here. And here they are. dE equals 0, and dS is greater than 0. And that's all thermodynamics. Now, is there anyone in this room who's had calculus? Ooh, look at them. Well, you guys really have a liberal education. Well, you understand my formalization here. For those who have not had calculus, E here represents energy. This is a mathematical statement. dE equals 0 is a mathematical statement of the fact that energy can neither be destroyed or created in any kind of a process, be it a chemical reaction or something mechanical or electrical or hydrothermal, or whatever it is. Any kind of a process that goes on in the universe, there's no destruction of energy. And this is a mathematical statement of that. Now, the small d is from calculus, and it means a change. And when we use the letter small d, we mean an infinitesimally small change. In other words, if I make some small change in the energy, I can't. This mathematical equation says you can't. Any change in energy is equal to zero. And that's the same as making a statement that energy can neither be created nor destroyed. This little shorthand expression means the same thing. All right, now the symbol S refers to entropy. E stands for energy, and S stands for entropy. Both of these things, entropy and energy, are abstract terms. It's not something that a child is going to grasp. It's an idea you have to jump in and swim with for a while to get the idea. When we try to say what energy is, we say that it's the ability to do work. And you've probably run across that somewhere if you've taken a physics class or a science class somewhere in high school. For example, we'd say that a battery has energy within it because it has the ability to do work. Now, we have to accept that theoretically. Seawater has energy in it, just sitting there, it has energy in it. It has the ability to do work, but you can't meet all the circumstances in a practical way. Theoretically, I can see how there's endless energy in the sea just in the heat content. There's thermal energy in the ocean. all kinds of it. But nobody knows how to get that out. Now, the idea of entropy is a much harder concept than energy to get across. Entropy really has strong philosophical implications. And I hope that Dr. Goetz will be speaking of some of those things on this lecture. I think he will. Now, let's see if I can get the idea of entropy across to you. There are a lot of things that are the result of this statement. Any change in the entropy, as some chemical process or any other kind of a process takes place in the universe, is greater than zero. What this says is that when things go on, when an automobile runs, or when I walk, when anything takes place, the entropy of the universe is increasing. There's a quantity in the universe which, whenever something happens, the entropy increases. Now, the philosophical the idea of entropy came from engines. The development of steam engines is where the idea of entropy came from. But a more modern idea is that entropy represents disorder. And a guy by the name of, just the guy who has the tombstone with the words on it, D-entropy, what's the general word for off? D-entropy of Derveld, if it's Der or Develt, a maximum zu Strisform. I don't remember the general word for that. Anyway, the entropy of W-E-L-T, Welt in German means universe, not world. You'd think it mean world. But anyway, the entropy of universe is trying to go towards a maximum. Boltzmann. Is that right? Boltzmann? Doesn't seem right. Anyway, the equation for entropy, and this has nothing to do with that. You can have entropy without this equation. This is a modern philosophical interpretation of entropy. S is equal to R, which is the lower gas constant. I need to talk to you about that sometime. Times the natural log of omega. And omega is the increase in entropy when a system goes from one state to another. Everywhere heat engines work, like automobile engines, gas turbines, steam engines, entropy is discharged into the universe. Disorder is created.
Now, if omega is an increase in entropy, then you're just defining entropy in terms of itself.
Now, this function here is a randomness function. It's a pure number. Random. It's a measure of disorder. It's a statistical probability kind of thing. Jeff?
One question that always bugged me was the fact that in any living organism, DS is greater than zero is always seems to be denied.
No,
because if you look at
look at the universe,
and then the whole increase is greater for a small.
Yeah, there are BYU religion professors and a dean of this college who I think still does. They go to the This Is Your Religion series in California sometime. And they say that science's law of entropy is all wet. Witness living beings, which go from disorder of the dust we come from into this wonderful organized creation. Well, they're not looking, they have tunnel vision like all our congressmen. They're not looking at the entire picture. The system is the universe, you see. Sure, I am a wonderfully organized creature. And so are you. And consequently, our growth has fought entropy. But we have done that at the expense of entropy, which has been created elsewhere. Now, I don't know. You know, an extrapolation from what we observe on the Earth to the whole universe is really a large, probably a very arrogant extrapolation, but we do it all the time. Well, let me see if I can give you some other handles on entropy. all systems flow in a direction, as this said, where entropy increases. Now, we're just going to have to... This thing is circular, like learning a new word in the dictionary. It says... any word you see, you go to the definition and then you get back to the other. Eventually, if you go around through enough definitions, it's just around and around. Which means that you just come to understand things by your experience. And that's what you have to do with entropy. To get a real feel for it will probably be difficult for you to get in this class. It took me years to get a feel for entropy. Now I feel it's a real, genuine, honest, to goodness thing. But they are abstract concepts. All systems, and I need to tell you what a system is. We use this word in science a lot, particularly when we're dealing with thermodynamics. We speak of a system. And you talk about the thermodynamics of that isolated system. Lots of times this has to be a mentally isolated system, because in theoretical or in actual experimental practice, you can't isolate the thing. But a system is the thing of interest. Like my interest might be a 1 pound brick of gold. I have really neat interest. A 1 pound brick of gold. And I may want to know how much the temperature of my brick of gold rises if it's at 25 degrees centigrade and if I pump into it 140 kilocalories of energy. Well, that's the realm of thermodynamics. You can solve problems like that very exactly. But you focus your attention on that. Now the entropy somewhere will increase. I may focus my attention just on the increase in entropy in the gold, or decrease, as the case may be. Or I may focus my attention only on the surroundings. Or I may focus my attention on the gold plus the surroundings, which constitutes the universe. And see, that's the error that some of the religious teachers still make. They focus their attention on a chosen system, namely man. And they fail to look at the rest of the system, which is the universe, at least this world. See, which is good enough for the universe for us. And in the universe, the entropy always increases. While for your specific system, which you isolate, it may decrease or increase.
Well, for life to originate, say, by organic evolution, there'd have to be some random decreases in entropy offset by grosser increases in entropy throughout the whole system.
That's right.
But to get like first protocell, you have to have some appropriately random decreases in entropy, right?
If there were evolution and if it occurred by chance, you'd have to have that. You might be interested to know that, see, in the field of science, speaking about evolution, speaking against evolution has been a no-no for years. And if a guy doesn't really necessarily believe in it, he's really an outcast. What kind of science is he, But in recent years, there have been some articles appeared by rather brave men, brave journals, I guess, who have published analyses of the situation in more modern day with computers and whatnot. And I've seen at least 3 articles in the past half dozen years by mathematicians saying that by chance it never could occur. Just impossible. Statistics against it, probability function is such that it's just too low. Couldn't possibly be. And there are quite a number of scientists who agree with that. They still have faith. They would never use that word, but that's what they do have. They have faith that evolution occurred, but they don't really know how to explain how come. Now, you can see the change in the rocks. You have to agree with that. That in the older rocks, there were little organisms, and they got more and more complex as the rocks got newer and newer. And that probably is the most propelling, at least to me, circumstantial evidence that there may have been evolution. But circumstantial evidence can really fool you. You have to be very careful about circumstantial evidence. And maybe it isn't so. But that, to me, is the main evidence, and it's circumstantial evidence for evolution. But as for it happening by probability and by chance, boy, that is a zero to remote possibility. So some scientists, some Mormon scientists who like to still believe in evolution because all their outside friends do, say that evolution occurred, but it was guided by the Lord. So there's that school of thought. And then, well, there are lots of schools of thought. All right, some other things that happen if you deal with heat. Now, in chemistry, we talk a lot about heat because in chemical reactions, there is almost always heat given up or heat absorbed. So we will deal a lot with the subject of heat. Thermodynamics really applies to any kind of a system. You can apply it to a system of radiation, a system of magnetic fields, a system of gravitational fields. Any kind of event there is, thermodynamics can be applied to that. But for chemistry, we'll talk a lot about heat because of the heat changes that apply. Now, if we're talking about heat, experimentally, heat has only been observed to flow from hot to cold. Well, that's not too good a diagram. Only flows from hot to cold of itself, you know, by its own free will.
Is that just go by definition?
That's experience. That's an observation. Heat flows from hot bodies to colder bodies. It only goes in that direction. Now, man can make it go the other way. Refrigerators do that. But you create entropy and expend energy by doing it. But the natural process of things is that heat only goes from hot to cold. Now, I think you know that the absolute cold is absolute zero. North Pole and South Pole, well, they're mighty cold, too cold for us, still are a long ways from absolute zero. And heat, you see, in theory, can flow from the North Pole to something that's still colder, if it's there. And we do such things in experiments in the laboratory. We will have heat flowing from something that's within 1/10 of a degree of being at absolute zero to something that's at 0.05. degree of absolute zero, and we can actually measure the heat flow in calories. Men do it all the time in low temperature laboratories. You're getting cold because we're talking about that.
Wow, the
psychological response here is really great.
She's a good candidate for waking up from the dead. Huh?
So that's another thing. Heat flows only spontaneously from hot things to cold things. Heat engines work with gases, and the only work on thermodynamics concerned gases, and some of the easiest thermodynamics has to do with effects on gases. So let's go back to the property of gases. I'm going to have to talk to you about the gas law. Don't think I've done that, have I? Experimentally, it's been observed that the pressure of a gas increases if the gas is confined and you heat it. Now, you've observed that. On a cold day, you've seen the tires on your car kind of flat, especially in the wintertime. And then when the day warms up and it gets hot and you get out on the highway and the friction of the tires on the highway heat them up, then the tires expand and they come out to full run. So we can say the pressure is proportional to an increase in temperature. The higher the temperature, I'll put a proportional sign in here. That means proportional. What this little thing says is that as temperature increases, pressure increases because volume is constant. All right, now how does volume go with an increase in pressure? Your instinct tells you if you increase the pressure on a gas, it's going to decrease in volume, doesn't it? So that's an inverse function. So pressure is inversely proportional to volume. Now the quantity of a gas that I have would affect things. If I have a fixed volume and a fixed temperature and a fixed pressure, if I introduce more gas molecules, which I could do by having a chemical reaction take place which produced more gas molecules, the pressure would increase.
What
we talked about Ida Gatter's number and the mole concept. I thought we had. Okay, N is the number of moles in a system of interest. So, if I increase the number of moles in a system, everything else being held constant, that would increase the pressure. See, I have this volume here, and I have a chemical reaction, NH3, which I make yield its nitrogen, and its hydrogen. Is that balanced? Not yet. Yes, it does. I guess it does. On this side of the equation, I have 2 moles of nitrogen. Over here, I have 1 mole of nitrogen and 3.5 moles of hydrogen, which makes a total of 2.5 moles on this side and only 2 on this side. So if that chemical reaction took place at a constant temperature and a constant volume inside of this fixed thing, my pressure would increase. All right, now, all this mathematical relationship now needs to put an equal sign in here is to put a constant in. Put in a constant, which we name R, and we call it the molar gas constant. And we deduce that by our common sense. This thing's called the perfect gas law. And it's not very perfect under many conditions.
Perfect gas law.
For perfect gas, this law is perfect. All right, now this law, most laws in science only work under restricted circumstances. This is a very good law at high temperature and or low pressure. And that's a good law. Now, if the pressure is high or if the temperature is low, then there are better laws. Can be developed. But for this beginning class, this simple elementary gas law would be the only thing we ought to consider. This is usually rearranged to be PV equals NRT. Just multiply both sides by volume. Now let's take a gas. In engines, we have this kind of a thing. We have a cylinder, and we have a piston. And let's put a weight on top of this piston so that we have a constant force down. This piston is gasketed with a frictionless gasket. No such thing, but you can, by experimental techniques, you can make a gasket essentially frictionless. We don't want to get into those details. You can actually do an experiment where you approach very closely having a frictionless gasket. Now let's do some gas law manipulations. If I have a pressure in here, 2 atmospheres. And a temperature of 25 degrees centigrade. Let's see, this is my pressure, and this is my temperature, and this is my volume.
We have to be using absolute temperature.
Let's say it's 1 liter. Next. Now, I'm working gas law problems, and for this class, I'm not going to go into the details of it. I'm just going to tell you. You do not work in degrees Fahrenheit, or do you work in degrees centigrade, but you work in degrees Kelvin. Degrees Kelvin, which sometimes are called absolute, the absolute temperature. Centigrade temperature is converted to absolute temperature, or degrees Kelvin, by taking the degree centigrade and adding 273 degrees to it. So in degrees Kelvin, if I add 273 to that, that's the same as 298 degrees Kelvin. In using this equation, it is most convenient to state pressure in atmospheres volume in liters, which is 1,000 cubic centimeters, temperature in degrees Kelvin, and N as a pure number, the number of moles. It's just a pure number, number of moles. And if you do that, this constant, which you determine by experiment, and determined by theory too nowadays, a theory of Reasons experiment, has the value of 0.0821 liters atmospheres per mole degrees.
That's R.
That's what R. R has that value. All right, now if I change my volume and keep the temperature the same by letting heat flow in, when gases expand, they cool. So to keep the temperature the same, I'd have to let heat flow into this thing. Well, I could expand that gas by reducing the weight up here, which is giving me my pressure downward. So if I change the pressure, it's possible for me at constant temperature to find what the new volume is. And you could apply this gas law right here to work all kinds of problems relating pressure, volume, R, and T. Now if I lift that weight, or if I press the weight down, that's going to take some energy. Engines work by having a gas in here which expands. You have steam which is heated, which can expand and do work against the piston. You have gasoline air mixture in here explode, which can expand and do work against the piston. So we are dealing in heat engines with work and with heat. And to express this thing right here, which we call the first law of thermodynamics. This is the first law of thermodynamics. We can say this, that the energy of the system is equal to the heat, given by the symbol Q, absorbed by the system, minus the work done on the system. Now all those, you have to write down exactly what I said. Otherwise,
didn't say it again.
Otherwise, this sign might be plus instead of minus, and this sign might be minus instead of plus. Now I've mentioned to you before that the hardest thing is in science is knowing whether the sign is plus or minus. And you're going to find that out right now. It's the semantics of the thing. And a problem in science is that the physicists say it differently. So that the physicist's definition is Q plus W, and the chemist's definition is Q minus W.
What's Q?
Heat absorbed by the system. I think I said it the physicist's way. I have a minor in physics, and I have trouble with this, because you learn one way in physics, and you learn the other way in chemistry. I think the chemists are more consistent. Look, you heat this up. If you heat this gas in this cylinder somewhere, then it does work. And the gas you notice I put a little hole in here. There's air in here at one atmosphere. And it has to push out and push the rest of the atmosphere away. So it's doing work on the universe, doing work on the outside system. So E is the energy of the system after something happens.
Going to include some E naught at all.
Yeah, you know too much. I'm trying to keep this simple. When you try to keep things simple, you get in trouble. But you get in trouble when you make them hard, so you can't win.
What's W?
Well, he's asking me, don't I have to have some reference energy state? Yes, I do. All right. Since all you guys know calculus, we'll do it this way. dG is Q minus dW.
What's W?
Work done by the system on its surround.
I think I told it to you the physicist way the first time I said it.
All right, Q is the heat absorbed by the system. We're going to produce a change in the energy of the system. And our engine produces that. Okay, so we put heat in here. Alright, heat is absorbed by the system. And dQ represents the amount of heat absorbed by the system in an infinitesimally small process. We just do a little bit. We expand this only a little bit of distance. Minus the work done by the system on the surroundings. System had the piston, the piston moved,
it had to push back the atmosphere. Now if we did it in a vacuum,
then the piston only had to lift the weight. I guess it was lifting the weight anyway. Let's do it in a vacuum so that there's nothing in here impeding that piston coming back, and it's only lifting the weight. In this case, then, the work done is just lifting the weight. So for a chemist, while this is the fundamental, very beautiful, poetic statement of the first law, a chemist usually uses this, because a chemist is dealing primarily with the subject of heat and with work. I'll be too hard on all this stuff. It'll be good for some of you, though. It'll be good for all of you, at least to have been exposed. Can't you just see the beauty? I mean, you talk about somebody's poetry. Boy, that has to beat anything you ever saw. Let me tell you what comes out of that. From these two simple little mathematical expressions, it is possible to generate billions of mathematical equations relating to thermodynamics. Not just 10 or 20 or 30, billions. Now, most of those would not be useful. The ordinary chemist maybe uses a maximum of 50 mathematical equations that you derive starting with these two basic fundamental concepts. But there is nowhere in all of science where you have this implicit beauty expressed like you have it here from two little dinky equations. Very simple and very beautiful, both of them. One of them equal to zero, the other one greater than zero. You can derive billions of mathematical equations relating to the subject of thermodynamics. Well, we'll try and work our way into thermodynamics some more for the next 2-3 weeks. So bear with it. You might want to get a book. Most chemistry 105 textbooks. The 100 textbooks don't usually get into this, but if you pick up a chem textbook such as a physicist or an engineer or a biologist would have to take for his chemistry course. It'll have more than what I'll tell you in it. And it's fairly simply expressed. Okay, we'll see you.